This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on September 15th, 2016. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
We'll turn to the next item on the agenda. If I can find my agenda, which is now buried under a stack of papers.
Yeah.
I borrow Commissioner Hunter's agenda, which is Commissioner Ravel's proposal to rescind advisory opinion 2006-15 TransCanada. That is set forth in agenda document number 16-32-A. I'm assuming I will recognize you first, Commissioner Ravel.
Thank you, Chairman Peterson. As I indicated before in the previous discussion, and much of that discussion is probably applicable to the discussion that we're going to have here, and I'm going to try not to repeat a lot of it, but we have received in 1 month since I put this proposal on the agenda nearly 2,000 comments, both from concerned citizens, some incredibly thoughtful and incisive comments that talked about some of the issues that we've discussed at the table, the ranking member of the House Administration Committee, which is the committee that oversees the FEC, as we know, lawyers.
That committee?
Yes, I thought you were. Lawyers, law professors, and nonprofit organizations. And over 99% of those comments support my proposal to rescind the AO and express grave concerns, such as we've been talking about today, about the influence of foreign nationals and foreign corporations that they're having now on our elections, particularly since Citizens United. And, you know, you've all responded since I put this on the agenda with your own proposals. As I've indicated before, I think this proposal is a preliminary to the rulemaking and actually need to be considered in tandem because it's very important before we enter into the rulemaking, which is so badly needed in this matter, that we first clarify the law. And we know that while there has been discussion of this, perhaps even in a MER, as you indicate, after Citizens United, most of what we have considered at this agency has been previous to Citizens United and based on old views that have absolutely no bearing on the present legal environment and factual environment that we're facing in this country. I think incumbent on us. In fact, I think it's imperative that we revisit this and take a look at it. And I want to echo something that I think there was a little dissension about, but that Commissioner Weintraub mentioned about the fact that there's never been complete consensus even on this particular AO or on this view relating to foreign subsidiaries. In fact, there's a lot of discussion. Commissioner Walter himself was a no vote on this AO, but also Bob Lenhart has indicated a lot of concerns about the way that we have been looking at subsidiaries of foreign corporations because of the extreme difficulty of the issues of control and what control means, and in the real world, those subsidiaries are obligated to the owner. They are obligated to the owner. So whether or not there is a person at the top who is saying you must contribute to my favorite candidate or not, by principles of corporate organization, where the fiduciary responsibilities lie, those subsidiaries have obligations to follow through on the financial and also, in some cases, political perspectives of the foreign owner. So all of these reasons sort of militate for us to take a look at this again. And I need to say that this problem that we're facing, and I know on one side of the table you like to talk about the Constitution, and someone at the, as we do too. And someone, I believe at your very good forum, spoke about this, but anyway, she submitted a comment about it. And the United States Constitution has recognized the danger of foreign interference in the Emolument Clause, a very well-known clause of the Constitution. Did you want to comment about the Emolument Clause?
I think I took an entire class on the Emolument Clause.
Yes. Right. And it says, no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. And this was explained by Supreme Court Justice Story, who says the clause as to the acceptance of any emoluments is founded in a just jealousy of foreign influence of any sort. And it's really significant that it says any present of any kind whatsoever. That is a pretty strong statement and justifies the concern about having intermediaries or others actually being the donors in the case of foreign gifts. I think also it's important for us to look at the way the world is now with these corporations. And I know Ellen spoke quite a bit about this, but I think it's important for us to remember that we're really vulnerable to the influence from foreign nationals through their subsidiaries in a way that was totally unimaginable a decade ago. And so it renders, I believe, the prior consideration of all these issues moot and have definitely undermined the assumptions that were part of the AO that we're considering today. First off, also, given our inadequate disclosure and failure to address issues of disclosure post-Citizens United at this very commission, given what some of the professors spoke about with regard to the SEC and the fact that there is not very significant disclosure as to the contributions, political contributions, and other issues through foreign corporations, for us to think that we're actually capable, given that lack of knowledge that we have, of determining whether there is this involvement of foreign nationals is not credible. It is not credible. And I believe in the forum, the great forum that Ellen put on, what Dean Donald Tubin, who we talked about, he summarized it really well. I love this. And I think I've even seen it in some of the cases that have come before us. He says, considering the existing rule that foreign nationals are prohibited from engaging in electioneering communication, in simple terms, a foreign individual could create a Wyoming corporation. The Wyoming corporation could be the sole owner of a Delaware corporation. That, in turn, could own a Nevada corporation. The Nevada corporation could then engage in independent expenditures on behalf of a candidate. For those who don't practice corporate law, I hope I picked the four most difficult corporate states to be able to break the corporate structure. So because of Citizens United, our rules are now truly divorced from market realities. And several people in commenting on the proposal today echoed that same concern. One commenter noted, the obvious problem in the Commission's guidelines is that they ignore the reality of how corporate decisions are made. We should have no doubt, and this comment is by Mr. Holman, who I believe is perhaps still here, we should have no doubt that the campaign contribution decisions made by the American directors of U.S. subsidiaries would be influenced by the foreign owners of the company. Subsidiaries of an entirely foreign-owned company are not likely to act in a vacuum and make decisions about the company's money contrary to the wishes of the company hierarchy. So as I also mentioned, the intersection of our rules, not only with the SEC but with the IRS, means that there's a significant disclosure gap. Professor John Coates also noted in the forum, $1 in $4 in value terms in U.S. corporations is controlled directly or indirectly by a foreign owner. Now, what kind of foreign owner? Well, we don't know. It's part of the disclosure gap. It could be individuals, it could be companies, they could be governments, and of course, in many countries like China, where governments and businesses are essentially identical, and so a little hard to tease out, even if you know the country from which the investment is coming. What more fundamental feature of our government is the protection of the republic? Foreign interest and domestic interest are going to predictably diverge. And we also have to think about the rule and the AO in terms of the people who are supposed to follow it and tell their clients about it. And it is a major concern that lawyers are advising clients based on an oversimplification of these rules and presenting a system to their clients that is ripe for abuse. For example, a recent legal memo informed clients that a U.S. subsidiary, as long as it's chartered and principally operating domestically, is not a foreign national and may participate. This obscures the fact that foreign parents may exert direct or indirect control. And many campaign finance lawyers have said that the compliance regime presents a lot of compliance challenges. Allen and Overy, for example, informs their corporate clients that aspects of potential direction or control can be more administrative challenging, and that it's incumbent on each corporation to select a reasonable method for its own operations. In a comment, one of the other comments we received, Noah Bookbinder has said it well. The FEC should recognize that legal and factual changes have rendered the current rules preventing foreign influence insufficient to the Commission's statutory mandate and should begin the process of modernizing them. And, you know, uniformly, as I said, people think that this AO needs to be rescinded and that we have to go forward with rulemaking, including Ranking Member Brady, who said, I fully support the rescission of Advisory Opinion 2006-15. Collectively, these and the, you know, 1,999, whatever, 900, highlight the need to clarify the status of the AO and other AOs that purport to permit domestic subsidiaries of foreign contributions to make contributions or donations, either directly or through SSFs in connection with federal, state, and local elections, so that we can give guidance to the regulated community as an important first step in enacting new rules. Thank you.
Do we have any discussion on this motion? Commissioner Gooden?
I've read many of the comments that have come in. I didn't read all 2,000 when it was about 100. I was caught up.
You read 100?
Yeah.
It's a very small number.
Well.
Representative sample.
It was they were very similar. Uh-huh. I understand that American people don't want foreign money and foreign nationals donating their campaigns. I agree with that sentiment. So did Congress beginning in 1966. And we're debating here over how to go about implementing that policy judgment, not whether to implement it. All of us here have voted to enforce the foreign national ban. I think you and I are the most recent people to arrive at this commission, and we've even had opportunity to vote on matters involving violations of the foreign national ban, and we've done so. But there are some serious questions raised by the comment that we received from the Center for Competitive Politics signed by Alan Dickerson. And I guess he addresses his comments directly to your proposal. And so I guess I would like to start with, how do you respond to his procedural points? He says that there is a statute that says we can reconsider an advisory opinion within 30 days. And that there is no procedural mechanism for 10 years later rescinding, by the way, not just this one advisory opinion, because the rules in TransCanada predated the TransCanada 2006 advisory opinion. In fact, I was curious about why you started with a 2006 when actually the opinions on which that advisory opinion are constructed began in 1978. So could you address the procedural issues raised in that comment?
Yes. Well, and I also would welcome if counsel would want to weigh in, because I consulted counsel prior to, as I always do, prior to making a particular recommendation. As you know, every AO ends with a statement that says that it's premised on the facts, and it says it in TransCanada, by the way. The commission emphasizes that if there is any change in any of the facts or assumptions presented, and that such facts or assumptions are material to a conclusion presented in this advisory opinion, then the requester may not rely on that. It's my view, and I think it's others, that these are material facts that they've changed, that the just the enactment of Citizens United since that time presents significant, anyway, changes, as I've indicated before. And revisiting conclusions and advisory opinions is something we do all the time. It's something that we've done in the past. Last year, by vote, six commissioners agreed to revise an advisory opinion in the reporting of IEs that run in multiple states in an interpretive rule. So while we didn't do that, but we agreed to do that. So it's absolutely within our purview.
So why didn't you propose an interpretive rule? I mean, I'm just looking at the procedural mechanism of being asked to rescind an advisory opinion that's been in existence 10 years, and I think the intent of it is really to go after about, a dozen to 20 advisory opinions going back to 1978 if we really were going to rescind the whole rule. So, but the proposal before us is to rescind one and its lineage. I guess I don't know that it's procedurally that we're procedurally capable of doing it the way it's postured. And the facts and assumptions.
Maybe we could.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I don't know whether your counsel willing to weigh in on this at the moment, since I received counsel.
The key phrase in that question is, I think, at the moment. We've been consulted informally by numerous commissioners' offices on this question, and we've given informal advice, the same informal advice to each commissioner's office that is asked. Given that this is an open meeting, I'm not sure that this would be the venue to repeat it, but if there's commission interest in a more formal opinion, we can always provide that in a separate venue.
Is it possible to at least ask the question, as far as you are aware, has there ever been, has an advisory opinion ever been superseded outside of either a subsequent advisory opinion or through a rulemaking process? Has this mechanism, as far as you know, ever been used before to rescind an advisory opinion?
The example that Commissioner Ravel gave, it almost fits that pattern. There were, all six commissioners were interested in promulgating an interpretive rule that would have rescinded or superseded or otherwise done away with the Western Representation PAC advisory opinion. It didn't happen because there was disagreement as to the content of that interpretive rule, but as far as I know, all commissioners were in agreement that that interpretive rule could supersede an advisory opinion. It didn't happen. Before that, I don't know.
Commissioner Goodman, I believe you have the floor.
Well, I'm just struggling with the procedural mechanism that's presented to us, which the facts and assumptions stated in an advisory opinion refers to the facts and assumptions presented by that requester, not that legislative facts, what's happening in the world beyond that might change it. It has to do with the facts presented, and the only facts that I've heard you present is one that Citizens United changed the legal landscape, but it didn't change what TransCanada did, and Citizens United explicitly didn't alter the foreign national ban. It actually explicitly says we're not addressing the foreign national ban. So I guess I just don't know that procedurally we can just rescind an advisory opinion that a party came and obtained through the procedural mechanism of rescinding an advisory opinion, where the facts and circumstances for that requester are the same.
I disagree with you. I don't think that facts and circumstances is solely related to that particular person's situation. The circumstances have changed radically in terms of how applicable the law is. And given that this commission is so unwilling to enact rulemakings, and we use AOs as substitute rulemakings when in fact they should not be, but they are used as precedents for others to follow, I think it is particularly incumbent upon us to look at this in the light of not just Citizens United, but the world, the changing world in terms of multinational corporations, in terms of, you know, subsidiaries, American subsidiaries, and the fact that the analysis in that case was applicable to a different time, and it should be revisited. It should be revisited, in particular, if we are planning to do an NPRM, actually under any circumstances, but in particular if we're going to do an NPRM, so that we have a clean slate.
Well, if the commission were going to undertake an NPRM, then we could clearly address this rule head on and take on an advisory opinion. It just seems procedurally that would be the more graceful way to do it.
Well,
I understand
your
position. I'm not particularly persuaded by it, but going to, I am persuaded that an NPRM would be the proper way to do it, not simply rescinding an advisory opinion and then vaguely alluding to a whole bunch of others that we are rescinding along with it. I believe that actually leads some vagueness in the field. So if we were to rescind this one and vaguely anyone like it, you would, I take it, thereby remove the legal protections that all of those requesters obtained from their advisory opinions? Would that be the legal effect of a vote here to rescind advisory opinions?
I think it would express what the commission has already expressed, which is some question about the validity of the reasoning in that AO. And so the those people who are engaging in this practice would have to think about what they're doing.
Okay, while people are thinking
carefully
about what their rights are in that, in the wake of a motion or a vote to rescind, what's the extant law in the meantime? Because my understanding what the law is, I'll tell you what my understanding is and you can react. Mm-hmm. It would be this regulation. Okay? This regulation that is explained in an explanation and justification that accompanied its adoption. You haven't moved to rescind that explanation and justification.
Right.
And that explanation and justification is premised on all of those advisory opinions. So even if you rescind those, the commission still adopted that reasoning anew in 2002, along with the legislative history of BCRA, and all of the comments that came from Senator Reid and others that said, no, we're not affecting the rights of American subsidiaries. So I don't know what's accomplished thereby other than adding some confusion to the field. Even if we were to undertake an NPRM, it would take time. And so the law would be in a, seems like a vague state of flux as to the requesters who got advisory opinions, but every lawyer out there would then default to the regulation as written and the ENJ that explains it. And so, I mean, that's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
That's probably correct. And, you know, frankly, that for the brief period of time before we have our rulemaking, and I'm glad to hear you supporting the idea of an NPRM as well as a rulemaking, I hope.
We'll see.
Yes, we'll see. We have that situation in many of our places where there is a void of rulemaking, many. And so this would not be any different from that.
Let me jump then to getting more to the substance. Because you say that Citizens United, and Commissioner Weintraub said this as well, was the game changer that changes our legal thinking on how to define foreign national under the Act, which in turn turns to the Foreign Agent Registrations Act definition. Legally, Citizens United said nothing about that definition. I mean, I think we all have to concede. Citizens United said, we aren't passing on the foreign national prohibition. Making the argument that Citizens United somehow changed political giving in the political system or expenditures is only really half true. Because while it opened up foreign nationals to make independent expenditures or to give to independent expenditure groups, foreign nationals prior to Citizens United had given to the soft money accounts of the DNC and the RNC. Foreign nationals had given to state and local candidates. And so foreign nationals and the definition of foreign national was well established aside from CU. So why is it that Citizens United fundamentally was a game changer in forcing us to try to reinterpret the definition of foreign national in the statute?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Can I ask a point of clarification? Because now I'm really confused. I thought I heard you say earlier that you all agreed that the foreign national ban was broad and capacious and prevented any foreign national from doing anything. And then I thought I just heard you say, and maybe I didn't hear it right, or maybe this happens when people are speaking, maybe a word got slipped, but I thought I just heard you say that you thought it was legal before Citizens United and presumably after for foreign nationals to give to all sorts
I misspoke.
Okay.
What I meant was corporations.
Okay.
And U.S. domestic subsidiary. You're absolutely right.
Interesting that you equate those, though.
No. My point was that foreign nationals were prohibited from making those contributions prior to Citizens United, although corporations could. Thank you for calling that up. So corporations prior to Citizens United could make donations to the national, the soft money accounts of the DNC and the RNC, as well as state and local. Citizens United changed where corporations could give into maybe a different area of politics, but it didn't fundamentally change the issue that the commission has had to address for 40 years, which is corporations giving generally, and trying to prohibit that activity of foreign nationals that might touch that giving.
Yes, and I think you're looking at it a little narrowly, because while that's true, mm-hmm. What didn't exist at the time, and I, of course, was not at the commission, so I don't know what it was that the commissioners saw at that moment, but it's quite clear that the amount and the ways of giving has now expanded exponentially. And that's where all of the comments comes in, because people are aware of them. Commissioner Weintraub spoke of some of them, some of the concerns about, you know, countries, foreign countries that are associated with their businesses. You know, all of these things have changed since that time. And that was occasioned by Citizens United and its progeny. That's the difference.
Point taken. Okay, I understand that. I wanted to clarify that, I think, because I think the point is that, well, that while the amount of corporate participation has increased, Citizens United didn't change the law. So, and we're called upon to implement the law in perhaps in a changed environment, but the law is still the law. So how do we...
Well, and also let me add one thing, which is that because of the independent expenditures, as I mentioned, the ability to funnel money from one LLC to another, or from one 501c4 or c6 to another, has changed for corporations, and we do not have disclosure rules, nor does there seem to be an appetite to have them either enact them or enforce them. But we don't have an ability at the moment to determine whether or not that is foreign money that's okay. giving that money.
The changed circumstances.
That's right.
The lay of the world out there.
That's right.
What do you make of the fact that Congress was fully apprised of the of the definition in the statute and of the commission's regulations and proposed to change that in 2010, did not, and has not addressed changes in the foreign national prohibition in all the subsequent right. iterations of the Disclose Act? What do you make of that? Because
I make
it impresses
nothing
me.
Of it. I actually make nothing of it. I think they had it there because there was a serious concern about this issue, and there's a serious concern about conduits and intermediaries. They even enacted criminal sanctions for it, but there was not. They were attempting to make a deal on the Disclose Act, and that's the reason, that's the only reason that it was dropped, and it does not, as far as I'm concerned, constitute legislative history to have you say that as a result, Congress doesn't want, you know, think this is an important matter.
It's not necessarily my point. Point taken. I guess my point is Congress knows how to address this in the wake of Citizens United. Right. And if Citizens United has changed the First Amendment tolerance for regulation based on your paradigm in the New York Times, that, you know, it's the ownership that constitutes, then Congress has had 6 years and has not done so. I don't necessarily read that as legislative history, but it seems to me that because Congress has always been in the forefront of changing the definition from 1966 to 1974 to 2002 to a proposal in 2010, the definition right now has been static in the law since the Citizens United decision, and clearly Congress is fully apprised. So that's my point.
Right. Well, let me respond to that. I don't know how apprised Congress is, honestly, about the functioning of our commission, but nonetheless, the point is, irrespective of Congress, we have an obligation. This is our job. Mm-hmm. We have an AO. We have a particular way of setting forth how subsidiaries can operate in giving contributions when they are subsidiaries of foreign organizations. It is incumbent on us, I think, to look at that and say, you know, that's not working. It's not working. It's not the right standard. We need to look at another way of dealing with what is an acknowledged problem. That's all I'm suggesting. I'm not changing the law. I'm not doing any of those things. I'm saying, let's say this is not an appropriate way for people to be able to shield these contributions. There needs to be more constraints, and let's go forward with the rulemaking.
Okay. But you are changing the law. I mean, you're proposing to change the definition of foreign national to a broader notion of foreign-influenced money to be captured in our regulations implementing that statute, despite clear legislative history in 2002 that said that's not what we intended under this we don't draw a blank slate, and we're not a law unto ourselves. We make good on the law that Congress has given us, and the law that we have today is the law that Congress gave us in 2002 in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and you're proposing to broaden out from that to regulate U.S. companies and the American employees of those companies. This is 60 to 70,000 Americans who work for Chrysler USA, and thousands of employees work for Ben & Jerry's in Vermont and elsewhere, and 700,000 citizens of California who work for foreign-owned companies of one type or another. And so you are suggesting that we expand the notion or the definition of foreign national in a way that's contrary to what this commission considered that Congress, the law Congress gave us in 2002. By the way, I'm sympathetic. Citizens United changed a lot of activity. I guess I've made the point that it didn't wholesale change because American corporations that were owned by foreign nationals were already participating in American politics. But we don't write on a blank slate. We're not a law unto ourselves.
Yeah, well, you know, even in your own proposal, which we both repeated, you said that because of the IEs, because of the other aspects of corporate giving now, it's a case of first impression. It's new. It's something that calls out for a new policy, in your view, that didn't pass. But, you know, it calls out for us to revisit it. That's my entire...
Let me ask you just one last question, Mr. Chairman, because your proposal uses new terms from... The statute we have prohibits foreign nationals from making contributions and expenditures, and the regulations we have broaden that out beyond the actual making of it. Your paradigm is to expand the notion to something called foreign-influenced money with this notion. So I guess turning back for a second to the comment that the Center for Competitive Politics gave us, what's your reaction to pages 16 and 17?
I don't have it in front of me. Sorry.
Well, I'll summarize what their comments said. The proposal, this is your proposal, assumes that U.S. subsidiaries and the U.S. citizens who run them simply cannot be trusted, and that their loyalties cannot help but shift to the interests of their foreign owners. And then the comment is that this is a cynical and unproven assumption with vast consequences. It goes on to talk about how all of us at some point are paid by maybe foreign clients, if you're a lawyer, and that it suggests that we should not call into question the loyalties and have suspicion about the loyalties of millions of American citizens just because of where they work. And so I guess, and it is difficult to ratify a proposal that's based on that presumption. And so I'm asking your reaction to this comment.
Yeah. Well, first off, let me say, you know, with respect to the issue of those employees, I mean, those employees have the right to contribute to campaigns. There is not any issue about that. It's about the corporate-sponsored PAC. And they can do, there's no question that they, as Americans or citizens with green, or foreigners with green cards or all of the others, can participate in the political process. And that's what we want. It's the question of whether or not they can be influenced as Commissioner Weintraub talked about, but also, I mean, there is some evidence. There is a recent study put out, and I believe one of the authors is from the University of Arizona. I can provide it to you offline, where they said that they found that political giving and political activity by employees is very influenced by CEOs of corporations. So there is evidence of that. And then just if you look at corporate structure, as I referred to before, the subsidiaries, the employees, they are all working for the corporation. They are all, the fact that they're a subsidiary, it's not an entity unto itself. They are loyal to and must do what is in the best interest or perceived best interest by the CEOs of that corporation. That's the difficulty that we have in formulating some kind of a rule here, honestly, and why we have to look at what we have set forth in the AO as being incomplete, because it doesn't actually address that problem.
But focused on the separate segregated funds, when American citizens who work for Chrysler in Detroit donate their own money to the Political Action Committee under the umbrella with the administrative costs paid by Chrysler USA, I mean, is it your position that the employees of Chrysler, when they give their own money to a political association and make their own decisions about how to spend it, even if they are making decisions about what's good for the auto industry in the United States, okay, what's good for Chrysler in the United States? Now, Chrysler's owned by Fiat. Are you saying that we have to presume that those decisions are inherently disloyal to American interest when they're making decisions for their own jobs for Chrysler and the auto industry in the United States? I mean, why do we make that presumption in this proposal?
I think that that's saying something that I never have said, nor would I ever say. I do not in any way view this as a proposal that is based on the disloyalty of American citizens. So please don't try to mischaracterize what is an actually reasonable proposal based on our experience, which is that corporations have financial interests. They, when they contribute, and when they set up, even setting up the SSFs, asking their employees to contribute to what are the interests of the corporation, it's done on behalf of the corporation, not those individual employees. Those individual employees might agree or might not. We don't know.
But assume
and
they
that's
do.
That's the issue.
I'm sorry. I talked over.
Yeah. No. And
but
that's
assume
the
they
issue.
Do. Assume the
right.
Because assume. That the employees of Chrysler give to a Chrysler USA PAC. It's their own money. Their contributions are voluntary. And even assume, for the sake of this discussion, that when they make political expenditures out of Chrysler USA PAC, They are doing so given their economic interest in their employment at Chrysler USA, which has plants across America and probably 60,000 to 70,000 American employees. Why would we take that right away with them? Because you said earlier, by the way, I'm not trying to mischaracterize it. You did make the argument about fiduciary loyalties and where they lie
That's
first.
Right.
So that, and that is the comment before us. I was asking your reaction. So you, I take it, so that's why I said you're questioning their loyalty and whether their loyalty is in American interest or it's to fiat in Italy. And
I think their loyalty is to the corporation through the senior leadership, the CEO and the senior leadership, which happens to be a different a foreign corporation. That's the rule of corporate law. That is. I'm not saying anything about loyalty per se of a particular employee. And, you know, frankly, I think it's interesting that you're raising these issues because, as Commissioner Weintraub mentioned earlier in her discussion, you know, we had a case before us about PAC and contributors to a PAC who were clearly being, not foreign, but clearly being pressured to do something on behalf of the views of a particular head of that organization. And that didn't trouble the FEC. We split on that matter. You didn't think that it was within your purview. It
troubled some of us.
Yeah, it troubled troubled me greatly.
Yeah.
But so clearly, there. What's the avenue? What's the avenue for dealing with the problem that you seem to think is a problem of foreign involvement in our electoral process?
I'm not sure that it is extinguishing the rights of American employees who work for Chrysler and Ben & Jerry's and numerous other foreign-owned companies to associate under an umbrella because sponsored by their employer. Because remember what this is by law. It is not the corporation. It's called a separate segregated fund for a reason. It is a separate, it is not the corporation's money. It is a separate segregated fund that the corporation merely facilitates for those employees. It takes their personal money in, and they make the decisions to spend their personal money out, and therefore there is no fiduciary duty imprinted on that separate segregated fund to fiat in Italy. There is not, because it's not the corporation's money. Now, informally, I said, I grant you, the employees of Chrysler may want to vote the best economic interest of Chrysler in USA. They may indeed do that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that their interests are not in harmony with basic U.S. interests. So that's, I guess, a fundamental concern I have about your proposal here today. So, Mr. Chairman, I yield.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. There were many times where I thought about trying to interject myself, but it seemed like there was no...
We were having so much fun.
And frequently what I was about to say, my colleague said... Anyway, so it eliminated the need. But I just want to make a couple of points. Point one, I support the proposal, which, as my colleague said, would kind of clear the decks in preparation for rulemaking that I sincerely hope we'll be able to launch. I think this notion that these thousands of employees of Chrysler or any other big company are, you know, personally invested in and exercising their choice through the PAC, I think is just not in practical reality how it works. They don't, most of these employees who contribute to the PAC have no say it. I mean, I don't know how Chrysler does it, so I don't want to pick on them, but in most big corporate PACs, the individual employees who contribute have no say at all about who gets the money. That is determined by a manager who is often hand-selected by the CEO, who is hand-selected by the foreign owners. So there actually is a connection there, and as I said earlier, you know, we know that entities that are closely aligned with the government of China have been buying up companies in the United States. We know that the Saudis have been buying up companies in the United States. I mean, let me give you the most dramatic example I could come up with. So let's just posit for a moment that three ISIS fighters who happen to have, you know, come from families with money, decide to buy an interest or buy an entire company in the United States. Are you really comfortable with that company, you know, playing in our elections? You're willing to say, oh, well, that's fine. You know, it may be owned by ISIS, but, you know, these are American citizens who work for ISIS, so that's okay because they're the ones you're going to. I mean, that is, you know, you can shake your head if you want to, but that would be okay under your theory, I assume. And that's, you know, maybe that sounds like a ridiculous example, but,
yeah,
you know, I don't know.
It does sound like that.
I don't know how far removed it is from foreign governments who we know have state-owned enterprises that are buying up interests in the United States. We know this happens.
Commissioner Hunter.
Just focusing in on the domestic subsidiary. So I think what you're trying to say, and I think Commissioner Goodman was trying to isolate this also, is a U.S. citizen who works for, let's just keep the Chrysler line for a minute here, a U.S. citizen who works for Chrysler shouldn't be able, I think you're saying, to contribute to the SSF because the people who work for the domestic subsidiary for Chrysler will by definition be influenced in how to direct that money by fiat. Is that what you're saying?
Personally, yeah. I'm saying something a little bit more moderated than that.
Okay.
I think that possibility is definitely out there, and I want to pursue that inquiry.
I'm sorry, what possibilities are out there?
That the people who are making decisions about how the corporate PAC money is being spent are being influenced in some sense or are carrying out policies that they know would be in the interests of their foreign owners.
But
I
you
think
that
is a real possibility, that the decision about how the money is being spent, because as I said, I think most of the people who contribute to it have no say at all over how the money is being spent in most big corporate PACs. I think that's just the reality. And as my colleague said, those people are perfectly free, and nobody's trying to say that they shouldn't be spending all the money they want to contribute to every candidate they want to support the political causes that they want. Nobody is saying that that is a problem at all, whoever they work for. But what I would like to pursue in a rulemaking is, you know, what is the status of these domestic subsidiaries of foreign owners? And I think my colleague's proposal is to clear the decks for that rulemaking so that we don't have, in the meantime, people giving advice based on this particular AO.
If I could just dive down a little bit further. You said that what I said sort of overstated it. Could you state what you think it should be for a U.S. citizen giving to an SSF for a domestic subsidiary who's owned by a foreign parent? Should they be able to give or not to the SSF?
That is an issue that I want to explore in the rulemaking. And as I think I mentioned before, I'm willing to consider the possibility that we should look at SSF separately from corporate treasury spending. I don't know whether there's, and I haven't decided yet whether there's a legally defensible way to get there. But I'm willing to look at that.
You don't want to blanketly say that a U.S. citizen shouldn't be able to give to this SSF.
That's not what I'm saying today.
You don't want to say that. Okay. But it's, and now I'm not going to reiterate what you're saying. I'm going to say what I think you're thinking is, but you want to have some kind of safeguard to make sure that the foreign company isn't deciding how to spend the money. And guess what? We agree with you, and that's the current law. And so I think a lot of this is talking past one another. You want to make sure that fiat is not deciding how to spend the money that people voluntarily gave to their SSF, people who are American citizens voluntarily gave to their SSF. And there are all kinds of safeguards in the reg, in the ENJ, and in various advisory opinions, which are spelled out in the proposal that we put forward today. And TransCanada themselves, from the AO that you guys want to get rid of, specifically said that there were all kinds of safeguards, strong measures taken to ensure that its activity was not swayed by foreign influence. they did all kinds of stuff, and it's in the record in that AO to say, we agree with you. We want to make sure that this money is, the decision on how to spend it is made by the American people running the U.S. subsidiary. So I actually think we agree, at least with respect to how SSF should be operated.
Commissioner Weintraub.
You may have more, I suspect you do have more confidence that, you know, there are adequate safeguards in place right now.
But I think the difference, and this comes up, this is something that's, sorry, this is sort of common in the enforcement context and here, that we're generally a little bit more willing to accept the representations of people that are made to the federal government, often under penalty of perjury. If someone attests to me that they haven't had any influence by the foreign parent, I tend to believe them, and especially contrary to evidence, you know, otherwise. And you don't. And that's just a completely different way of looking at this. You know, I actually have a friend who runs a domestic subsidiary of a huge foreign national corporation. I'm going to call him and say, you know, how does this work? He's in charge of a lot of American citizens, and I'm sure that he follows the rules and makes the decisions on his own.
Commissioner Weintraub?
With all due respect, I don't think we ought to be making government policy based on what your husband told you or what you learn when you talk to one friend.
No,
I think what we need is a rulemaking where we gather a broader number of perspectives before the commission.
In that same vein, we should also not be making broad statements on the basis of speculative theories on what may or may not be going on with corporate governance. I mean, a lot of what's been said is not based on any evidentiary record. It seems like it's a lot on speculation on what may or may not happen. So I think I think it's good advice for all of us to follow that we should be careful about how much we're relying on theoretical boogeyman to prosecute our case. But Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, I'll just say, I mean, Commissioner Goodman does this all the time. He draws on his experience as a former practitioner, as do I. And, you know, that's in my experience of advising clients, I never encountered a corporate PAC that, you know, gathered everybody together who was contributing to the PAC and took a vote or sought their input in much of a way at all as to who would get the money. So it is, I'm not drawing on complete speculation. It's informed by my experience out there in the world.
Right. And on that point, I don't think that because PACs may not meet one's idyllic notion of how freedom of association ought to operate in the perfect world, and I don't think that freedom of association and the freedom of speech, I think that the founding fathers were not Pollyanna-ish in their views either. In fact, I think that many of them had very dark impressions of what basic human nature was. But I don't think that, again, because some ideal is not met, that one's associational freedoms are somewhat diminished. And that's why I was a little bit troubled by the suggestion that because American citizens who are employed by a domestic subsidiary of a foreign corporation, well, sure, I'm not talking about infringing upon their rights, since they would still have the right to contribute. I think that really does give short shrift to the associational freedom that the Supreme Court has talked about at length. I don't think the Supreme Court is under any delusions over how PACs or other associations operate, but I don't think just because they don't meet what we would think would be the perfect world of what how associations ought to operate and how the decisions within those associations operate, I don't think that diminishes their freedom to associate at all. And so I'm troubled by that suggestion. You were reaching. I'll let you respond to that. And then there was just one other question. It's about 1 o'clock. So
we want to
why don't you respond?
Well,
there was one thing I wanted to ask, and then I was going to suggest maybe taking just a quick break, and then come back and resume consideration. And
I don't know why we don't just take a vote. I mean, it's pretty clear.
Well, we move.
Well, you can finish.
Okay.
Finish what you were going to say.
Let me just. We've talked kind of around this issue a little bit, but I'm not sure it's been addressed directly. In the and Commissioner Weintraub's memo and in your the memo attached to your motion talks a lot about Citizens United being this game changer, how the line of advisory opinions that establish the framework for domestic subsidiaries of foreign corporations to be able to establish political action committees and to engage in expenditures were permitted by law, that somehow when Citizens United came down, was handed down, that changed everything. Now, I can understand to some extent how that changed. It obviously worked a large impact in general, but let's dig down to this specific issue. It did expand now that the corporations who could only previously make independent expenditures and contributions on the state and local level were permitted by law. They could now do so at the federal level. But I've got to say, for the life of me, I do not see how that was a game changer with respect to domestic subsidiaries of foreign parents and their ability to establish PACs. Because before, the only thing that a corporate PAC can do, that a corporation that is the sponsoring organization for a corporate PAC, is they can pay to, it talks about the establishment, administration, and solicitation costs. And I read earlier the from 110.20, talking about the broad prohibition on foreign national involvement, direct or indirect, on any decisions. And there is nothing post-Citizens United that altered any of that. So, I'm not saying this to be glib or sarcastic or anything. I honestly do not know how, with respect to the corporate PACs of domestic subsidiaries, how Citizens United had any impact on it whatsoever. Because whatever avenues of leakage there were before were still there after, or I should better say that anything that happened after were still there before. So that's the one assertion that I've had trouble with all along. Because to me, I think that the framework has remained the exact same, at least with respect to those corporate PACs. So that's if one of my colleagues can enlighten me about how that framework changed, I'd be interested to hear it. But I just, like I said, in all of my analysis of this issue, which is I don't think I've ever drafted up more talking points for any open meeting before. But that's one issue that I just don't understand. And if we can't agree on anything else, if there were ever just agreement on that issue, that framework for that hasn't changed, that would be helpful. And then the issue about independent expenditures and contributions and all that you know, that we can have that as a side discussion. But I would throw that out for consideration. And if we want to think about that for a second, why don't we take a brief, like, 5-minute break? And then meet back here, and then we can make a motion. I apologize for not mentioning that, as with respect to this particular agenda item 10 is a statement of Commissioner Walther regarding this motion, and that really should have been included as part of this agenda item. So I don't want to give short shrift to that as well. And so we want to make sure that you get the full chance to address that as well. Commissioner?
Maybe we could proceed to a vote on this and then take a break.
Okay. Okay.
Why don't we do that?
Then let's make the motion so that at least we can put a check through item 7 on our agenda.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And then we'll come back afterwards and proceed as
supported.
Commissioner Rabel.
I move approval of agenda document number 16-32A, proposal to rescind advisory opinion 2006-15.
We have a motion on the table. Is there any further discussion on that motion? If none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
Madam Secretary, that vote fails by that motion fails by a vote of 3-3, with Commissioners Ravel, Weintraub, and the Vice Chairman in favor, and Commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and myself opposed. So why don't we take a 5-minute recess, and then when we come back, we will pick up agenda item 9, which is Commissioner Weintraub's proposal.